She was just 17 when she crawled out a bedroom window, starved, broken, and barefoot, and exposed a horror the world never saw coming. For years, 13 children were held captive by their own parents, shackled, beaten, silenced in the name of God. But this isn't just a story about unimaginable abuse. It's about the fire of one girl's courage. It's about reclaiming a stolen life. From the shadows of chains and scriptures to the battle for healing, this is a raw, intimate, first-person journey of survival, rage, and redemption. Welcome to The House of Horrors, where freedom began with a whisper and ended in a roar. Welcome to the Murder Tape Chronicles audiobook. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you The House of Horrors, a true crime survivor's story. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The Girl in the Window. They always said that monsters weren't real. They lied. Monsters don't need claws or bloodshot eyes to be terrifying. Sometimes they wear nightgowns and glasses. Sometimes they're your mother and father. And sometimes they tell you they love you as they tighten the chain around your wrist. My name isn't important, not yet. What matters is the story. What matters is the moment the silence cracked open and spilled everything out. The secrets, the screams, the rot that had festered in the walls for decades. It started on a cold morning in January 2018. I was 17 years old, and I had never seen the inside of a classroom. Never eaten a warm meal I hadn't begged for. Never owned a key to anything, not even my own life. I remember waking up to the sound of coughing. My little brother, the one with the gap between his teeth and bones like twigs, was wheezing again. He slept at the foot of the bed I was chained to. His ankle had been cuffed the night before. Mom said he looked at her wrong during devotion time. That's all it ever took. A glance. A whisper. A breath out of sync. I laid there for hours, staring at the cracked ceiling, the paint curling like burnt skin. I traced shapes in it with my eyes. Anything to escape. There was a part of the ceiling where water had leaked once. It had left a brown mark that looked like a wolf. I used to pretend that wolf would break through and tear the whole house down, that it would eat mom and dad and spit out the keys. But no wolf ever came. Just me. Just my thoughts. Just the rusted chain clinking every time I dared to shift. That morning, I knew it had to happen. I didn't know why that day felt different. Maybe because I'd heard my brother cry in his sleep. Maybe because I'd watched my sister's eyes go glassy, like she didn't want to exist anymore. Or maybe because something inside me, something stubborn and primal, finally snapped. I had to try. I had to fucking try. I had stolen a cell phone from mom's room 2 days earlier. It was ancient, screen cracked, barely holding a charge. But it worked. I waited for mom and dad to fall asleep after their prayer hour. That was when they read aloud from a Bible so warped with tabs and underlines, it looked like a textbook from hell. They used it to justify everything. The chains. The starvation. The beatings. Spare the rod, spoil the child. Dad used to whisper, right before the belt kissed our backs. I slipped the phone under my shirt. It was freezing outside. We didn't have coats. Just the same pajamas we'd worn for months. I remember the air burning my skin like fire. I was barefoot, stepping over broken tiles, trying not to make a sound. The window had always been the weak point. The lock was rusted through. It squealed when I pried it open. I froze. Listened. No footsteps. No growls from mom. No keys jangling from dad's belt. I climbed out. My legs shook. Not just from the cold, but from the overwhelming wrongness of it all. I wasn't supposed to be outside. Ever. The last time I stepped into the yard, I was 10. It was a punishment. I'd talked during prayer, and they said the ground needed to cleanse me. I'd stood out there for 3 days. No food. No water. Just shame. But this time I was running. I made it 2 blocks before collapsing behind a mailbox. The street was dead quiet, like it didn't know monsters lived here. A dog barked somewhere far away. I gripped the phone like it was the last thing tethering me to life. My hands were shaking so bad I nearly dropped it. I pressed the numbers. 911. My heart pounded in my ears as the line connected. 911, what's your emergency? The voice was calm. Flat. Like nothing in the world could ever surprise her. I didn't know how to speak. I'd never made a phone call in my life. I don't know how to do this, I whispered. That's okay. You're doing fine. Can you tell me your name? I hesitated. My name felt foreign, like it belonged to someone else. But I gave it. I'm 17. I think. I don't have an ID or anything. I'm from 160 Muirwoods Road. My parents are holding us captive. There's 13 of us. We're all their kids. They hurt us. Please. I don't want to go back. She asked questions. So many questions. Was I hurt? Were there weapons? Could I get back inside? I told her about the chains. About the food, or the lack of it. How sometimes we went a week with nothing but peanut butter sandwiches and dirty water. How we couldn't shower but once a year. How they made us write letters to them every month thanking them for their love. She paused. Stay where you are, she said. I'm sending someone right now. The police car pulled up 20 minutes later, quiet as a ghost. The officer who stepped out looked confused, like he didn't expect to find what he found. I was dirty, thin. I looked like a skeleton wearing skin. My fingernails were black with grime. My voice cracked when I tried to speak, but I let him back. I walked him through the front door of the only world I had ever known. It hit him instantly. The smell. The filth. The chains. I heard his breath hitch in his throat. He didn't even try to hide it. And then, the radio crackled. We need backup. Possible multiple juveniles in distress. Send social services. Get EMS. Now. Inside, it was chaos. But not loud chaos. Quiet chaos. The kind that screams without making a sound. My siblings were too scared to speak. Too scared to look up. My youngest sister, barely a toddler, was in a playpen soaked in her own waste. My older brother, almost 30, was chained to the bed and so weak he couldn't lift his head. My twin sisters hadn't spoken in over a year. They communicated through glances. Blinks. Fingers tapping on the wood floor. The officers went room by room. What they saw, they would later say, haunted them. Starved kids. Rotting food. Blood on the walls. Journals filled with letters addressed to father, begging him to stop. Prayers that read more like suicide notes. When they took my parents away in cuffs, Mom screamed Bible verses. Dad didn't say a word. Just stared at us with those empty, dull eyes. Like we weren't even human. But I didn't feel vindicated. I felt hollow. Like I'd been scooped out years ago and was only just now realizing it. That night, they split us up. Hospitals. Social workers. Interviews. Photos. Reports. The first time someone offered me a sandwich, I cried. The first time I took a hot shower, I sobbed so hard I collapsed to the floor. The first time someone said, "You're safe now," I didn't believe them. Because safety wasn't something I understood. Trust had been turned into poison in our house. Love was a weapon. Discipline was torture dressed in religion. And freedom. Freedom was the scariest fucking thing I'd ever felt. But I kept going. Because for the first time in my life, I could choose something. And I chose to survive. I chose to speak. And this is just the beginning. Chapter 2, Shackles and Scriptures. The moment they took me away, I should have felt free. But all I felt was numb. The kind of numb that seeps into your bones and makes you wonder if maybe the silence was better. If maybe being invisible was easier than being seen. I sat in the back of that sheriff's car, legs tucked under me like I was still chained. It was instinct. I didn't know how to sit like a person. I only knew how to shrink. The deputy, he tried. I'll give him that. He kept glancing in the rearview mirror, probably trying to find something human left in my face. But I wasn't ready to let him see it. I wasn't sure there was anything to see. You did good, he said softly, like he was talking to a wounded animal. You were brave. I wanted to believe him. I wanted those words to wrap around me like a blanket, but they didn't. They just floated in the air, empty, echoing, like all the prayers we used to whisper into the walls. The hospital was bright. Too bright. The light stabbed at my eyes. Everything was white and clean and loud. Phones ringing, nurses moving, machines beeping. I hadn't been in a building that wasn't rotting in over a decade. The tile floor felt too smooth. The smells too sterile. The kindness too sharp. They stripped me down. I stood there, shivering in a paper gown, while nurses cataloged my body like I was evidence at a crime scene. Because I was. Bruises. Cuts. Healed over welts. Old cigarette burns on my thighs. My hair was tangled, matted, and greasy. The nurse tried to be gentle as she combed through it, but I winced with every stroke. Not because it hurt, but because I wasn't used to being touched without pain. They took blood. They asked questions. And when I tried to answer, the words came out cracked and splintered like broken glass. "When's the last time you ate?" they asked. "I don't know," I whispered. "A piece of bread, maybe 4 days ago? When's the last time you had a bath?" "Last Easter." They stopped writing. I saw their faces shift. That look, half horror, half disbelief. They didn't know how to hide it. But I'd seen that look before. On Mom's face when the baby cried too long. On Dad's face when we spilled food. It always came before punishment. So I flinched. They noticed. They softened. And that was almost worse, because I didn't know what to do with softness. It made me feel like I was unraveling, like all the strength I'd spent years building was about to dissolve under a warm hand and a kind voice. They put me in a private room. I think they thought it would comfort me. It didn't. I didn't sleep that night. I sat in the corner, knees to my chest, watching the door like it would burst open any second. That's what years of trauma does. It rewires you. Makes you suspicious of silence. Makes you terrified of peace. Because peace always had a price in our house. The shadows on the wall twisted into faces. Mom's face. Dad's face. Scripture verses screamed in my ears, even though the room was quiet. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. That verse had been painted on our living room wall in huge black letters. It hung above the couch like a threat. And when we disobeyed, even slightly, we were reminded of it. With fists. With belts. With days of silence. They said it was love. They said God commanded it. And when you hear something enough times, you start to believe it. Even if it's poison. The next morning, the social worker came in. Her name was Linda. She was in her 50s, with graying curls and laugh lines that didn't quite reach her eyes. She sat down like she wasn't in a hurry. Like she had all the time in the world for me. And that alone nearly broke me. "Do you want to tell me what happened?" she asked. I didn't. But I did anyway. Because for the first time, someone wanted to listen. So I told her everything. About the chains. The padlocks. The starvation. The school lessons that were just hours of copying the Bible until our hands cramped. How we weren't allowed to speak to one another without permission. How Mom rationed our food like we were prisoners. How Dad watched us bathe, when we were allowed to bathe, under the guise of purity inspections. Linda didn't interrupt. She didn't gasp or cry or look away. She just listened. And when I was done, she asked the question that gutted me. Why didn't anyone say anything sooner? I looked at her. Really looked at her. And I said, because we didn't know we were allowed to. You don't understand how deep the mind fuck goes until you're on the outside looking in. They trained us to be quiet. They trained us to be grateful for scraps. If you got seconds at dinner, you owed God a song. If you made eye contact during a beating, you were inviting demons. If you flinched, you were questioning God's will. And if you cried, oh, God help you. Crying meant rebellion. Rebellion meant sin. And sin meant being locked in the basement for days. No food. No light. Just the voices in your head, whispering that you deserved it. We prayed for forgiveness. We prayed for strength. We prayed for death. Whichever came first. Later that day, they told me my parents had been arrested. 14 felony counts, torture, abuse, false imprisonment, child endangerment. I didn't know what any of it meant. But I knew this. They weren't coming home. That night, I ate pizza for the first time. A nurse brought it in, smiling like she was giving me a miracle. I stared at it for 10 whole minutes before touching it. The cheese stretched in ways I'd never seen. The sauce was spicy. The crust was soft. I cried while I ate. Not because I was sad, but because I realized something. I was alive, and that terrified me more than anything. Because being alive meant I had a future. And I didn't know how to have one. Chapter 3. My parents, the strangers. They called them defendants. I stared at the word written on the court docket, printed in bold black letters beside the names I used to write with glitter pens on homemade birthday cards. David and Louise Turpin. My mom and dad. My monsters. I sat in a hard wooden chair in the courthouse lobby, knees shaking, heart stammering like it wanted to break free from my chest. A social worker handed me a bottle of water. I took it but didn't drink. Everything in me was locked up. Paralyzed. Like the chains had moved from my wrists to my soul. I hadn't seen them since the night they were arrested. The night everything burned down without a single flame. But now I would have to look at them again. Sit in a room just feet away, and listen while strangers described the things we'd lived through as evidence. Evidence. That's what we were now. Exhibits. Testimonies. Trauma turned into bullet points and courtroom procedure. It felt unreal. It felt like watching someone else's life. But it wasn't someone else's. It was mine. The first time I walked into that courtroom, my breath caught in my throat. There they were, sitting side by side in the defendant box, both in orange jumpsuits. Mom's hair was greasy, tangled at the roots. Dad looked smaller somehow, like the world had finally started caving in on him. Neither of them looked at me. Not once. But I looked. I looked at their hands. The same hands that fed us dog food and called it dinner. The same hands that adjusted padlocks around our ankles. the same hands that slapped the Bible onto the kitchen table and told us if we disobeyed, we'd go to hell. Those hands were now shackled. And for the first time, I wondered if they were afraid. I wanted them to be. I wanted them to feel even 1% of what we felt all those years. When the lights were off, the house creaked with menace, and every sound might be the jingle of keys coming to chain you back down. The judge read the charges slowly. Torture. False imprisonment. Child abuse. Willful cruelty. 14 counts each. I remember thinking, 14? There should have been thousands. But 14 was enough, they said, to put them away for life. The prosecution started with photos. Photos of us. Not how we were now, clean, clothed, trying to piece ourselves back together. But how we were then. Bones under skin. Matted hair. Filthy clothes. Chains cutting into flesh. My brother in the fetal position, curled in a corner. My sister's pale face, eyes dull and vacant. Me, sitting on the floor with bruises up my arm like a storm map. The courtroom gasped. People cried. Reporters scribbled notes like this was some blockbuster horror story, and not the shattered wreckage of real children. One of the jurors put a hand over her mouth and looked away. But I didn't look away. I watched every damn slide. Because this was our truth. And I'd spent too long pretending truth didn't matter. Then came the videos. Footage from Dad's phone. He used to record us. Not the way normal parents do. Not birthday parties or cute moments. He'd film us crying. Begging. Locked up. Being corrected. The prosecution played one clip where I was maybe 10 years old. I was chained to my bed, tears drying on my cheeks. He was filming me from the doorway. "You think this is unfair?" he asked in the video. His voice was cold. Flat. I didn't respond. I just looked at the floor. "You're lucky God gave you us," he said. "You're lucky we care enough to discipline you." The screen went black. I wanted to scream. I wanted to rip the monitor off the wall. But I just sat there, fists clenched, knuckles white, trying not to throw up. The defense tried to spin it. They said my parents were overwhelmed, that they loved their children deeply and were misguided in their methods. They said homeschooling was their right, that they didn't trust outsiders, that they feared the world and tried to protect us from it the only way they knew how. Bull. Shit. They didn't protect us. They didn't shelter us. They isolated us. Starved us. Beat us. Brainwashed us. They turned their home into a torture chamber and called it God's will. They had every chance to love us the right way, and they chose evil. Every single time. When it was my turn to testify, my legs almost gave out. The bailiff asked me to raise my right hand, swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, so help me God. The irony almost made me laugh. So help me God. God didn't live in that house. But I swore. And then I spoke. My name is, I paused. My throat was tight. I'm one of the children of David and Louise Turpin. I could barely say the word children. Because we weren't treated like children. We were property. Prisoners. And I told them that. I told the courtroom about the time Mom locked me in a closet for 4 days because I spilled water on the Bible. I told them how we were only allowed to shower once a year. How we went months without brushing our teeth. How Dad beat my brother with a metal bar because he asked for more food. I told them everything. Every chain. Every slap. Every night spent crying into the mattress because the hunger was too loud to sleep. And when I looked across the courtroom, when I finally let my eyes land on Mom, I expected her to cry. To break. To finally show some crack in her mask. She didn't. She just sat there. Expressionless. Like I was a stranger. Like I was reading a story she'd never heard before. Some of my siblings testified too. It was hard for them. Some of them couldn't even speak above a whisper. Some shook so badly they had to sit with therapists beside them. But they did it. We did it. Together. For the first time in our lives, we were fighting back. The verdict came down in April 2019. They both pled guilty. 14 felony counts each. No trial. No drawn-out media circus. Just a simple plea deal to avoid dragging us through more pain. 25 years to life in prison. Minimum. I thought I'd feel relief. I thought I'd feel justice. But mostly I felt empty. Because no sentence could give us back what they stole. Not just years. But identity. Trust. Joy. Self-worth. All of it. That night, I went back to my new foster home. It was small. Quiet. There were plants in the windowsill, and a dog that snored in its sleep. I sat on the edge of the bed, my bed, and opened the window. Outside, the wind moved through the trees like a lullaby. Soft. Gentle. Real. And I breathed. Really breathed. for the first time in years, and I told myself something I hadn't believed until now. It's over. They can't hurt me anymore. Chapter 4. Learning to be free. I didn't know who I was without the chains. Freedom sounded beautiful in theory. In books. In songs. In the soft-spoken words of social workers who said I was safe now. But freedom was loud. Too loud. It had colors I didn't recognize. Smells that didn't belong. People who smiled without conditions. Doors that didn't lock. Clocks that didn't mean punishment. And a silence that wasn't laced with fear, but with uncertainty. It wasn't just learning to be free. It was learning to exist. The foster home they placed me in was nothing like where I came from. For starters, there was light. Natural light. Sunlight streamed through the windows in the mornings like it had been waiting for me. Like it was trying to introduce itself. I didn't know how to meet its gaze. I was so used to filtered air and closed curtains and artificial yellow bulbs hanging above our heads like interrogator lamps. The first night there, I couldn't sleep. I laid in the bed, my own bed, they kept reminding me, but I kept expecting footsteps. Screams. The creak of Dad's belt being unhooked. I flinched at every sound, the house settling, the dog barking, a car driving by. My mind translated, every creak is danger. So I sat on the floor in the corner and wrapped my arms around my knees. That was familiar. That I could understand. When my foster mom, Sandra, found me the next morning, she didn't raise her voice. Didn't demand I go back to bed. She just knelt beside me, gently took my hand, and said, "You don't have to hide anymore." And I cried. Hard. Because no one had ever said that to me before. The first meal I had there was spaghetti. I didn't know what it was at first. Red sauce. Garlic bread. Salad. I stared at the plate, unsure if it was a test. Unsure if eating too fast would get me punished. In our old house, food was used against us. It was a privilege to eat, not a right. Sometimes they'd make plates and sit in front of us while we starved, saying things like, "You have to earn your blessings." Sandra said, "Eat as much as you want." I picked up the fork slowly, took one bite. It was like tasting color, salt, warmth, texture, a tanginess I'd never experienced before. And I cried again, because my body didn't know how to accept kindness. They sent me to therapy. Every Tuesday at 4 p.m., I sat in a beige office with a woman named Claire who wore oversized glasses and had a voice like honey and rain. She didn't rush me, didn't pry. She just waited. Week after week, I showed up and said nothing. Until one day I did. "I'm scared," I said, "that I'll never feel normal." Claire didn't tell me I was wrong. She just nodded and said, "Then let's figure out what your version of normal looks like." It wasn't easy. Healing never is. There were days I couldn't get out of bed. Days I punched walls. Days I screamed into pillows because the anger wouldn't stop pouring out of me. There were nights I woke up sweating, convinced I was still chained to the bed. Still being watched. Still being controlled. Sometimes I'd scrub my hands raw, trying to erase the invisible filth they left behind. Other times, I'd stare into the mirror for hours, wondering who the hell I was looking at. But then there were other days. Good ones. The first time I listened to music, real music, not hymns, my whole body lit up. I remember putting on a pair of headphones and hearing Adele for the first time. Her voice wrapped around me like a storm, and for the first time, I understood what people meant when they said music healed. The first time I held a pen and wrote in a journal without someone watching over my shoulder, I didn't know where to start. But the words came anyway. I exist. I survived. I'm not theirs anymore. Eventually, I started attending classes. Real ones. Not the fake Bible-based education our parents gave us, where science was sinful and history was whatever Dad felt like making up that day. I sat in a classroom full of kids who'd never known hunger the way I had, who laughed freely, who had phones and friends and lives. I felt like an alien. But then a girl named Melissa passed me a note during lunch. It said, "Hey, I like your hair." It wasn't a big thing. But to me it was. It meant I wasn't invisible anymore. My siblings were scattered across different foster homes. Some got adopted. Some stayed in group homes. A few struggled to adapt. I wrote letters. Long ones. Pouring my heart out on paper, telling them I was okay. That I missed them. That I was trying. That we were no longer alone. My younger sister, Leah, sent one back. She drew a picture of the sun and wrote in shaky handwriting, "You were brave. You helped us be free." I framed it. I still have it on my desk. Then came the interview requests. News outlets. Talk shows. True crime podcasts. Everyone wanted our story. They wanted to hear the horror, the twisted details, the religious fanaticism, the grotesque abuse. But few wanted to hear about the in-between, about the healing, about how hard it was to exist after survival. I declined all of them, except one. A documentary crew working with a trauma-informed psychologist reached out. They wanted to help us tell the story on our terms, control the narrative, use it to advocate for other children lost in the cracks of the system. I said yes, because if I had to carry this pain, it damn well better make a difference. A year passed, then another. I turned 19, got my GED, enrolled in community college, studied psychology because I wanted to understand how people could become what our parents became, and how people like us could climb out of that darkness without being swallowed whole. I started volunteering with foster youth, reading to them, sitting beside them when they testified in court, looking them in the eye and telling them, "You're not broken. You're not alone," because I knew what it felt like to be both. But healing isn't linear. Even 2 years later, I still couldn't look at a belt without freezing. Still couldn't walk down certain aisles in the grocery store without hearing Mom's voice in my head, whispering verses like knives. Still couldn't sleep in complete silence. But I could breathe. I could laugh. I could walk outside without fear. I could say my name out loud and not feel shame attached to it. And that was everything. Sometimes people ask me if I forgive them. My parents. The people who turned my childhood into a dungeon. And the answer is complicated. I don't forgive what they did. I don't forget the blood, the filth, the cries for help that were met with Bibles and belts. But I refused to let them own my future. They took my past. They don't get the rest of me. That's what freedom really is. Not just unlocked doors or unchained wrists. Freedom is the ability to define yourself after they tried to erase you. To build something sacred out of the ashes of everything they burned down. And I'm doing it. One breath at a time. Chapter 5, I took my life back. The first time I stood in front of a crowd and spoke my truth, I could barely breathe. It was a small auditorium in Riverside, a fundraiser for child abuse awareness. Maybe 100 people. Most of them didn't know who I was. Some did. A few whispered to each other when they saw my name on the program. I was that girl. The girl. The one who escaped. The one from the House of Horrors. But I wasn't there to relive the horror. I was there to reclaim my voice. I stepped up to the podium with shaking hands, took a deep breath, and then I began. "My name is Naomi," I said. "I'm a survivor. But more importantly, I'm free." It had taken me years to get to that point. Years of unraveling the trauma they wove into my skin like thread. Years of learning how to laugh without flinching. Years of talking myself down from panic attacks. Years of understanding that forgiveness and forgetting were not the same thing. That freedom was not a switch, it was a fucking war. A daily choice to fight. To get up when the nightmares pulled you down. To reach out when the silence begged you to stay quiet. To live. To really live. After I aged out of the system, I didn't go wild like some kids do. I didn't party or chase distractions or drink myself into a blur. No, I built, piece by piece. I got a job at a library shelving books, funny, considering we never had real ones in the house. I got my own apartment, small, one bedroom, but it was mine. I painted the walls yellow, because that's the color I always imagined freedom would be. I bought a secondhand couch and filled the place with plants. Not because I knew how to keep them alive, but because I wanted to try. Watching something grow under my care felt like rebellion. I adopted a cat. Named her Liberty. She sleeps at the foot of my bed every night like a reminder. You are not alone anymore. College wasn't easy. I struggled at first. I felt behind. My grammar was terrible. Math was like a foreign language. I had to take remedial everything just to catch up. And I cried more than once in public, frustrated, humiliated, exhausted. But I didn't quit, because I'd survived worse than a failing grade. I kept showing up, kept writing, kept learning. Eventually, I started writing essays about trauma, then short stories, then my memoir. It wasn't meant to be a book. Not at first. It started as journal entries, then blog posts. I thought maybe if I wrote it down, I could stop carrying it all in my chest. But then people started reading it and messaging me. I went through something like this too. You put words to something I've never been able to say. Thank you for speaking. You saved me. That was when I realized maybe my voice wasn't just mine anymore. The memoir got picked up by a publisher in 2024. It hit the shelves under the title Chain No More. I nearly fainted the first time I held it in my hands. Not because of the cover or the weight of the paper, but because it meant my story was real. That I wasn't invisible anymore. that the things they did to us, the things we survived, could no longer be buried under Bible verses and locked doors. It was out there, unapologetically. The media came back around, of course. They always do. Some of them wanted the gruesome stuff. Details. Clickbait. Trauma porn. I turned them down. But I said yes to the ones who cared about the kids still trapped in homes like mine. To the podcasts raising awareness about abuse in homeschooling systems. To the foundations pushing for oversight and reform. To the documentary crew who sat with me for 3 hours without once asking me about the smell of the house or what the chains felt like. They asked me what healing felt like, what hope looked like, what survival means when no one's watching. And I told them that survival is messy, that there is no straight line, that sometimes you'll look at a toothbrush and burst into tears because it reminds you of a childhood without hygiene, that sometimes you'll panic when you hear gospel music playing in a store because it sounds just like the soundtrack to your nightmares, that sometimes love feels fake, touch feels threatening, kindness feels suspicious. But you still move forward, because you can. One day, I visited one of my younger brothers at the transitional center where he was staying. He'd always been quiet, sensitive. He was 8 when we were rescued. He didn't talk for almost a year afterward. Now he was 16. He had headphones on and was sketching something in a notebook. I asked if I could see. He turned it around. It was a picture of our family. Not how we were, but how we could have been. Us smiling, eating, sitting around a table. No chains, no shadows, just light. And he said, I draw it the way I wanted it to be. I cried the whole way home, because even after everything, he could still imagine beauty, still believe in something better. My mother and father are still in prison. Every year, I get a letter asking if I want to be notified about their parole hearings. I always check the box for yes, because I want to know, not because I fear them, not because I want revenge, but because I believe the world should never forget what they did. Because forgetting would be betrayal. Not just of me, but of every kid who's ever cried silently in the dark, hoping someone, anyone, might hear them. I don't wake up afraid anymore. I still have bad dreams, sure. Still catch myself flinching when someone raises their voice. But I wake up. I stretch. I make my own breakfast. I water my plants. I walk outside. And I breathe. That's the revolution. That's the victory. Not just that I survived, but that I kept going. That I chose life. That I built something sacred from the ruins they left behind. So when people ask me, how did you do it? I tell them this. I didn't escape. I broke free. I cracked the silence wide open. I climbed out the window. I called for help. And when they told me my life was mine again, I took it. Not gently. Not politely. But with fire in my lungs and a scream in my chest. And I've never given it back. Not for 1 second.